This is the Tantalk Radio Network.
With a Z. Welcome to Joy on Paper, a program for writers and those who dream of writing, and for everyone who wants to know the story behind the book. Coming to you from glorious Clearwater, Florida, the perfect place for writers to write and readers to enjoy a good book. Oh, wow. What an honor and what a thrill today. I am going to be talking to somebody who is actually, he is the gold standard. He's the absolute gold standard for not just thriller writers, but all writers, because he is quite amazing. And I'm so honored that it is his birthday today. And I am welcoming to the program Lawrence Block. And we have a little something for you. How are you?
Hiya, Patsy. I'm good. How are you?
Oh, it's fantastic to have you here on your birthday. Well, it should be a national celebration. I'm telling you, you are amazing. As I said, you are the gold standard. Authors all over the world look at you and say, whoa, could we ever be like Lawrence Block?
I think most of them look at me and say, who's that?
Oh, no. You are so, you know, not just because you're a mystery writer of America Grandmaster, but you have mastered so much in addition to writing, because nowadays an author has to be also a self-promoter, and no one has learned it better than you, except perhaps Charles Dickens. You are like in that vein of absolutely knowing how to get out there and keep telling people about your work and making all these connections. And now, of course, with the new book, Writer Prepares, it is just a marvel.
Well, I'm thinking of writing an article, as a matter of fact, about I think the title of it is going to be How Not to Write a Memoir, because the whole saga of doing a writer's prepares has been an interesting one, as I'm sure you know.
Well, you started it, you stopped it, you put it away for a while, then you came back to it. And I think that was actually a great choice, because as a person is reading it, you're wondering, did he write this part 25 years ago? And it is, you know, it's wonderful when a memoir makes you laugh out loud, because sometimes, you know, you get so many angsty memoirs. Everybody is miserable. But, I mean, this book is so, you tell it in this lovely conversational manner. You tell all these little snippets and anecdotes. And there are so many times when one just has to smile or even laugh out loud.
Well, thank you. It's an extraordinary saga of how it came about, actually. Maybe I should talk a little bit about that.
Absolutely. Tell the story.
Well, I had no intention of writing about or even discussing my beginnings as a writer. And back in the 80s or 90s, I started writing professionally in the late 50s. And about 30 years in, I was starting to achieve some recognition in the field of mystery and suspense, and I was starting to go on book tours. And people would come up to me with copies of the early pseudonymous works that I'd written and want me to sign them, and I didn't want to sign them. I essentially wanted to disown that part of my past. I didn't categorically deny that I'd ever written the books, but I said I didn't want to sign them. I didn't want to talk about them. And then I don't know how that changed, but in 1994, I was in Ragdale, a writer's place one could go, and writer's colony is what it was called, an artist and writer's colony, and you had some time in seclusion there with all your needs met, where you could just work and focus on a work. And I liked that very much. And I was there, and I started something, and it didn't really work. And I had 4 weeks booked at Ragdale, and I had to have something to do. And I did a short story. I did a couple of introductions. And then one day I found myself thinking about those early books and those early years. And I thought maybe I should try writing about that. And I sat down and I started writing, and it was really as if I'd opened a door into a room I hadn't expected to find. And I was writing in white heat, really, Patsy. It was quite extraordinary. I worked all day, every day. I sat there at my laptop and typed furiously. And in a week's time, I think in about 6 days, whatever it was, I had 50,000 words written, which is the length of a short book all by itself. What happened, I would start writing something and a door would trip in my memory, and I would suddenly remember something I had not had any conscious thought of in 20 years, 30 years. And so it was exciting and gratifying, and it was also absolutely exhausting. I came home from the colony, and I would lie down on the couch until it was late enough to go to bed, and then I would sleep until it was time to get up and lie on the couch. I can't recall ever having been that profoundly exhausted mentally and emotionally before. And I didn't know what to do with the book, and I showed it to my agent, and he was about to negotiate a contract for future books with my publisher, who at the time was William Morrow and Company. And the contract I drew was for, I think, three or four novels, plus a writer prepares the memoir, which I would finish as part of the deal. And it was a small item in the contract. It clearly didn't carry much weight as far as the publisher was concerned. They were willing to do it. They were willing to pay a small advance for it. But it was clear that what they really wanted were the four novels in series, whatever they were. I think that they were to be the next four Matthew Scudder novels. I'm not sure of that detail. And then, that was in 1994, I guess. And then I never looked at the manuscript again. I put the, it was in a brown manila envelope. I put that in a closet in the shelf in my office, and I left it there. And I didn't look at it. I didn't go to work on it. I figured it would need probably another 40,000 words or so to be what I wanted it to be. And I forgot about it. And after a couple of years, nobody at Morrow ever called up and said, where is this? Because I don't think they gave a damn, really. You know, it wasn't important to them. It was the advance for it was money they'd paid to get the other books. It was, I'm sure, how it was thought of in their offices. And so I hate owing anything to anybody. It bothers me. And after a couple of years, I thought, well, if I can't even bring myself to open the envelope and look at what I wrote, I'm certainly not going to finish this, and I don't want to finish it, and nobody cares if I finished it anyway. So I made arrangements to pay back the advance they had given me for that book and to get the contract revoked. And nobody there said, oh, no, we really want this. And that was the end of that. I think they were surprised to see money come back to them, because there's a general principle that money you give to a writer, you will never see again. But it was worth it to me to get out from under this, even though there'd been no pressure. And then time went by. Patsy, you may have noticed that it does. and it did. And about, it was toward the end of 2019 when a fellow I know named Terry Zobeck was working on a bibliography of my work, which he has since published. It's called A Trawl Among the Shells, and it's a wonderful book for anyone who's really interested in my work, though, which is hardly enough to buy many copies of it, but it's a wonderful resource thing. In fact, I use it myself to find out when I wrote something or where something was published. And while I was doing that, I remembered the memoir, and I dug it out, and I actually looked at it for the first time in 25 years. And I sent, I actually had it in electronic form as well. Yes, of course I would have, because that's how I wrote it at Ragdale. So I sent it to Terry and said, here's this, you should note it, and what do you think of it? And he said, I think you should finish it and publish it, or you could publish it as is, or do something with it. And I went back to work on the thing. It was a little later, it was in the spring of 2020 when I went to work on it. And then, as you may recall, the whole country shut down.
Yes.
And I worked on it intermittently for the next 6 or 8 months, something like that. And it was a strange experience, because I was intermittently... I noted somewhere that it's as if there are three writers in the book. There's the writer in his 20s who's the subject of the memoir. There's a writer somewhere in his 50s who wrote the first section about that writer. And then there's this doddering old fool in his 80s who's trying to make sense of the whole thing. So it was an interesting experience writing it, and the reactions to the book have been wonderful, as you know.
Oh, amazing. Everybody loves it. Because what's wonderful, you know, memoirs by authors are an inspiration for other authors. Of course, for fans, this is what I always talk about at the beginning of the program, that if you want to know the story behind the book, well, the best way to know the story behind the book is to read a memoir by a writer. But your memoir is even more than that. It's so it's historical in so many ways because you cover an era that people were just fascinated about. And at the same time, it's something that a writer will look at and they'll say, whoa, how did he do it? And I think the big thing out of it, if anything, is that he wrote. That's the whole point. A writer writes, and you just wrote. And, you know, as a Midwesterner, my, you know, coming from northern Michigan, my dream was always to go to New York, get as close to New York as possible. If I could get to New York, everything, you know, because there's that writer's world there that you, you know, broke into coming from Buffalo. And then I was always surprised when I realized at one point, you know, after I got to know you, that there you were, you know, so close to New York City, in New York City, and then you went to a school in the Midwest. Explain how that happened. Why did you do that?
Well, I went to Antioch College because everything about the college appealed to me. I never considered going to school in New York. I figured I would wind up in New York City eventually. I had visited a couple of times with my parents during my childhood, and also in the books that I read, New York was seen as the cultural focus of the country, and I figured I would wind up there, but Antioch was a very, very good place for me to have gone to college, I think.
Well, because it was a very liberal school in many ways. It was one of the first to accept black students. So there was a lot to be said for it. Tell us about the journey and your first impressions when you went to the Midwest.
Well, Buffalo is in many respects a Midwestern city. It's probably Buffalo is a lot more like Cleveland or Milwaukee or Detroit than it is like New York City. So it wasn't that much of a departure in that respect. But Antioch's in Yellow Springs, which was it's still a small town. It was a town of about, I think, 2,500 then, and with a college with a student body of around 1,000. And the most remarkable aspect of Antioch, I think, was that it was founded by the great Horace Mann, the educator. And fairly early on, they instituted what was called the co-op program, so that students there would spend half a year on campus, generally in 3 months chunks, and the other half of the year writing in jobs of related to their fields of vocational interest. I spent the first full year on campus, as most students did, but then my first job was as a mail clerk in a publishing house in New York called Pines Publications. And that was, I talk about that some in the book, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
And that was an education. That was a look at the world of writing and publishing that I would not have gotten but for that job. And it was a job that was always filled by an Antioch student. So that was remarkable. Also, I was living in New York. I came to New York to take that job, and with a friend got an apartment in Greenwich Village, and this was in 1956, and it was a very exciting time to be there.
Well, of course, people always think of you as a New York City author. You bring the stories of New York alive. You always, you know, when people think about you, they think about New York City and everything that you write about there. And I often wondered, like, you know, talking about New York City in those days, did you ever dance in the Rainbow Room?
No.
No? Tell us some of the impressions there of New York at that time.
Well, gee, I don't know. In certain respects, it was quite different from the city as it is now. But the world 60 years ago was different from what it looks like now. So,
well, in those days, of course, people were wearing suits in the street. I was recently looking at some old photographs, and it's still so funny to see everybody walking down the street with suits and hats on.
No, there weren't that many hats. I guess people were still wearing, men were still wearing hats.
In the 50s.
The big thing that killed the hat trade was John Kennedy, who decided to go bareheaded to his inauguration. And I know my wife, one of her first jobs when she came to New York, Lynn grew up in New Orleans and came to New York in her late teens or early 20s, whenever it was. And one of her employers was I think it was called the Pan American Hat Company. And she said her boss there would curse Kennedy all the time as he watched his business going to hell. Because until around then, men wore brimmed hats all the time. In fact, if you see a photograph of people in the stands at a baseball game, say in the 40s or 50s, everybody's wearing a hat. Quite extraordinary.
It is. It is. I look at those photos and I think, it reminds me of my dad wore a hat during those years, and I love all those photographs. Now, you were at some point as your reputation grew. Now, you know, being sort of, I don't know, embarrassed of your earlier writing at one point, if you look back on it now, a lot of that writing is much better than what they're doing today, I can tell you that.
Well, I don't know about that, but I do know that my attitude toward my early work has changed considerably. Not that I'm apt to regard it as great or anything of the sort, but I certainly am not anxious to disavow it. And in fact, through the miracle of self-publishing, I brought virtually all of it back into print. And I'm not sure exactly what the motive there is. I suspect it's in large measure ego and avarice, because those are the things that impel me generally through life. But all of those books are back in print, and people are reading them again. So that's kind of interesting, because they were written, as I said, written and published in the late 50s and early 60s.
Well, you know, and it's funny when you think about it. Now, of course, on Wikipedia, you take up, I think, 14 pages, because you have a massive list of all of not just the books that you wrote, all of the awards that you were nominated for, all of the awards that you won. And I was looking at it, and you have the same number of pages as Albert Camus. Did you realize that?
Well, I use Wikipedia all the time, but one thing that I avoid is ever looking at my own entry.
Well, you are now...
I think my life will go much better if I stay with that policy.
Well, it's nice. Now, you know, you are on their list of famous people, birthdays. So, you know, you're up there with everybody who was born on this date, and so June 24th becomes a date that when forever, when people look at June 24th, they'll see you right there with along with kings and queens and all sorts of famous people, other famous people, because you are, as a matter of fact, probably you are one of the most recognizable names on that list.
I'm happy to be on any list that has Ambrose Bierce and Pete Hamill on it.
That's
and
it.
They were both born on June 24th as well, and did rather well for themselves.
And I think at the rate you're going, you'll have more pages than Albert Camus. Did you ever meet him?
Albert Camus?
Yeah, he was in New York at the time in the 50s. As a matter of fact, he loved the Central Park Zoo. He went to the Central Park Zoo 20 times because he loved that zoo so much.
Really?
Yeah. And I was thinking about you. Probably you took your girls to the Central Park Zoo.
Well, I've been there a time or two, but not in quite a while.
But he was, for some reason, he was enthralled with that zoo and went all the time. And
sure, he just didn't go there to look at little children.
No, he thought it was something incredible that he enjoyed the thing. Well, you know, his problem with thinking about where we are, we all animals or something. So I don't think so. I don't think so. They wrote about it nicely. Anyway, so you're, he won the Nobel Prize, and it's pretty amazing that after all these years, you know, you continue writing, and that's the great thing. You know, to have you here on your birthday is wonderful, because I had Eugenia Lovett West was on the program for her birthday, 97 years old. And she just wrote a book about cybercrime. I mean, at 97, she did a year's research into cybercrime, and she's 97.
And that is astonishing.
And going strong. And, of course, Lee Child was here for his birthday, too, because it's
Wesley's just... Wesley's birthday.
October 20... I can't remember. It's in October. Yeah. He was here last for his last birthday. He was here along with Drew or Andrew Child or Andrew Grant. I always call, and ever since we met here at BoucherCon, you know, I met you, and I met of course Jim and Andrew and Tasha were all here at BoucherCon, and that's one of the wonderful things about you, that you believe very strongly in the writers' community and getting together with people. I know that it's always great when you're at one of these events.
Yeah, I'm not going to get to it this year, though.
No, it's in New Orleans. At the best of times, New Orleans is not the place to go if you want to avoid people throwing up in the streets. I don't think it's
I like New Orleans very, very much, but I just don't think a convention is where I want to spend my time this year.
No, I don't think so. It was wonderful to see you when we were in Dallas. I love that convention. It was great. And again, I know all the authors are always so excited to meet you and just to hear about. And you cover that here in the book, too. Not so much advice. Well, advice, things that you tell people that they should, you know, think about when they're writing. And the main one, of course, is to write, to keep writing. And you were always writing, even, you know, when you were supposed to perhaps be doing something else.
Well, yeah, I was very... very much centered on the idea of producing work and publishing it.
And
that was very important to me.
So, tell us some more of the things that you talk about in this book, because when people want to know about you and the writers, when you talk about a writer prepares, you prepared virtually all of your life from the time you were 15.
I know one thing that I should probably talk about now is the job that was of the greatest importance to me in getting started as a writer, and that also that it was an Antioch job, but not one that the school found. It was one that I found myself during an Antioch a work period, and I was in New York, and I managed to get a job as an associate editor at a literary agency, and that was just the best possible training I could have had. I was in a relatively small office with maybe half a dozen other people. And my job every day, Patsy, as I mentioned in Writer's Prepares, was to read manuscripts submitted by would-be writers who paid a fee. Generally, it was around $5 and up. Per story, for the story to be read by the agent in chief there, a man named Scott Meredith, and then he would either take it out and sell it for them, or tell them how to revise it, or he would send it back with a detailed analysis of why the story didn't work. Well, of course, Scott didn't see these stories or write these letters. I and another fellow were tasked with reading these fee manuscripts, we called them, because a fee was paid with each manuscript. It was our job to read them and to write letters explaining why the story didn't work. And presumably, all of this was designed to get, material for Scott to represent as an agent. That was not the idea. It was designed to get people to send in their fees. It was an enormous profit center for the agency. And I was expected to reject, at least 99% of the manuscripts that I read. And I would write a letter, and I would do this 8 or 10 times a day. Read a manuscript very, very quickly, write a 2-page letter, analyzing it, the story in detail, and it was, in a sense, it was a con game, because we wanted that story to to pass off the board entirely with the letter that we wrote. We would praise the writer's style and ability. Even though his style was generally awful. You know, most of these people couldn't write their name in the dirt with a stick. And then we would criticize the plot of the story, because that way it could be regarded as unfixable, but we could encourage them to write more stories and send in more fees. Now, I was young enough so that the manner in which all of this was morally reprehensible somehow didn't dawn on me or didn't stop me. But what effect that all of this had on me was that it was absolutely the best training ground a writer could have had. You know, in college classrooms, people who want to be writers are given fine work to read. And you read terrific fiction. Well, it doesn't hurt you and all, but that it's very hard to see why a story works. You can't. But reading garbage all day is wonderful because you can see exactly what doesn't work. The bones show. And it was the greatest possible training ground. And Scott Meredith, for all the faults the agency had, served as a training ground for no end of writers, and for a while there, about half the editorial personnel in the city of New York and in the publishing industry. The number of people who had worked there for periods of months or a couple of years was enormous. It was a wonderful, wonderful training ground. So I spent about 8 or 9 months working there. By the time I was done, I'd published, maybe 15 or 20 stories and was ready to start a novel.
Did you ever come across a gem while you were reading these?
Yes, I did. I did. I found a couple of things in the drawer of fee manuscripts over the years. A confession story came in from a woman named Barbara Bonham. And I sat down and read it, and I took it right over to the what was called the pro man, the fellow who had to approve anything that I thought was good. And I said, I think you can take this right out and sell it. And he read it and okayed it. So I wrote a letter to Barbara Bonham telling her we were taking a shot with it. And he sent it out to one of the top confession magazines. There were True Confessions was a whole genre at the time. It's long since disappeared. He sent it out. It sold to the first editor who saw it. And we had a deal, within 24 hours. And very shortly after that, she sent a second story. I passed that on. We sold it to the same place and signed her as a client. So that was the fastest I ever saw anything happen like that. But there were others that I approved. There was a fellow named Charles M. Runyon who sent in a suspense novel. And I read it and I took it to the pro man and I said, I think this is good. I think, this is a gold medal crime novel. And he read it and agreed, and that's where it sold. So there were things that came in, but they were very few and very far between. Almost sometimes there were plenty of weeks that went by when I didn't pass on a single story, and some of the stories that I passed on were kicked back to me to reject.
Now, did you type up the replies? Did you sign them, or did somebody else sign them?
Oh no. Ostensibly, Scott Meredith signed them, but actually his brother and partner, Sidney Meredith, would sign Scott's name to the fee reports. So Scott's name was signed to them, but not by Scott.
Well, it would be fun if any of the people who were rejected back then still have those letters and of rejection, if they can come forward and put them on the internet and say, is this one of your rejections?
Well, the letters that we wrote, each of us had a particular subscript that, under the signature would say SM colon LB, for example, and that way
they could find it
in the audit.
Okay, well,
so that people in looking through the files could tell who had written it.
Well, any of you people out there who saved your rejection letters, most people throw them away, but if you've saved them and you see a little LB on the bottom, then you have a collector's item, right?
Well, I wouldn't call it a collector's
letter. Oh, yeah. Oh, would you sign it for somebody if they actually find a rejection letter that you wrote?
No.
No? Well, I think it would be fun. There are some authors who had so many rejection letters that they've, like, papered their bathroom with them. But I don't know that you've had a rejection letter. Because you write for the market, so you've always known to write what will sell.
No, that's not really
no?
true. No.
Did you have a lot of rejection letters?
Oh, sure. It would get slipped when I submitted directly. And you know, once I was working and selling at the agency, they represented me. But, you know, plenty of things were rejected. I didn't get letters.
This year it's too late, but, you know, perhaps in next year they should have a ticker tape parade for you. Did you ever go to any of the ticker tape parades there in New York?
No, never did.
Never? They've had so many during all those years that you've been there, and you never moseyed over to see one of them?
I'm not too much of a parade guy, Patsy.
Well, I think, you know, they should have one for you. My goodness, they've had one for the Shah of Iran and all sorts of other people. I think, you know, that would be nice.
Well, I think maybe not. Also, I don't think they have ticker tape parade anymore because they don't have ticker tape.
Yeah, well, now they throw toilet paper, I believe. They shredded toilet paper. And you've been through, I don't know
well,
how many mayors.
Oh, he shredded toilet paper at me for years, Patsy, but I wouldn't call it a parade.
Now, you've seen a lot of mayors come and go in the years that you've been in New York.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now, I did some work for John Lindsay once. Of course, he was a mayor back then.
Sure.
Which of the mayors sort of has stuck out in your mind? And do you get invited to events like that? Because you're so famous in New York, do you get invited?
No, I'm not so famous, Patsy, and I don't get invited to events. And when I do, I usually don't go.
Well, any mayor particularly stands out? Did you get to meet any of them?
I got to shake hands with Mike Bloomberg one time at some event, but that's about as much as exposure as I've had to politicians.
Do you?
And that's plenty.
Do you go to? I mean, there used to be. I don't know nowadays, of course, but there used to be a lot of events with publishers events, cocktail parties. I always dreamt about going to New York and to a cocktail party at one of the great publishing houses. Now, Jackie Kennedy, of course, was in the publishing business. Did you get to meet her?
No.
No? Did you attend these events? Did you like to do the cocktail party business?
No, not particularly. And Patsy, I'm going to tell you a story that I've always loved and that makes more and more sense to me with every passing year, and it concerns the great songwriter composer Irving Berlin. And when Berlin lived to be 100, as you may know, and for his 100th birthday, he was going to be recognized with a whole concert at Carnegie Hall. And this was a whole big deal with any number of important performers coming to sing his songs, and he was going to be honored and everything else. And he was at home with his wife. He had a long and very happy marriage. And as the hour for the concert began to approach, he and his wife looked at each other, and he was 100 or 99 at the time. And he said, well, I suppose if we're going to go, we should get dressed. He said, do you want to go to this thing? And she said, not particularly, but do you want to go? And he said, no. He said, the hell with it, let's stay home. So they stayed home. And you know, a lot of people found it astonishing that he stayed home and missed this great event and this honor. But it makes more sense with every passing year.
Well, I think if they have a ticker tape parade, you will have to attend. You will have to attend. But you've done so much, not just for, you know, for the writing community, with the anthologies that you created, giving so many writers the opportunity to, you know, sort of share in your glory, and that you've helped along. I think you've done a terrific job. You know, like Hillary Davidson is going to be my guest next week. And of course, she was in, you know, your anthologies. You help so many authors over the years with your work.
When someone's in one of my anthologies, Patsy, they're helping me more than I'm helping them, believe me.
Well, that's what you say, but they don't agree. They all agree that just, you know, sort of basking in your limelight has also helped their careers. And you've done a terrific, you know, just a terrific thing, I think, in continuing and being strong and learning really how to market in this day and age, because unlike many authors still have problems with marketing, you grasped it sort of by the horns and you've wrestled it to the ground and you're making a great success of it. And this new book, of course, The Writer Prepares, it's available wherever books are sold. And
actually, it's not available.
Not yet.
It's probably going to be difficult to find in stores, but it's widely available online.
Yeah, online, of course. Yeah, bookstores will, I don't even know if most of them are open. We still have some bookstores here that aren't open. So I'm hoping that they'll be open, but it's definitely online. And of course, they can go to your, you have a wonderful, wonderful webpage, and they can go there, lawrenceblock.com, right?
Yep.
And find out more about you there. And just, I want to thank you so much for being a guest on Joy on Paper on your birthday. It's a great day to celebrate. I know that, you know, I think often of your daughter, Jill, who has been on Joy on Paper, and I love her book, The Truth About Parallel Lines. And I'm hoping to have her back soon when she comes out with a new book. And I'm sure you'll come out with a new book again soon. So it's wonderful, really, Larry. I'm very honored that you were on Joy on Paper today.
Well, Patsy, thanks so much for having me. It's always a treat.
And very, very happy birthday. And again, my listeners, really, I always get such a tremendous response. And I always recommend your anthologies for, you know, all of the holidays, because it is so wonderful to give a book for a gift, because it is, you know, especially an anthology. So, Larry, thank you again for being on Joy on Paper today.
My pleasure, Patsy. Be well.
Okay. Thanks. Bye-bye now.
Bye.
Wow. His birthday. Whoa. My goodness. Yes, but he's going strong. And the thing is, well, the wonderful thing about it is really he has learned how to market. Every one of his books is back. He had to buy many of them back, get them back from the publishers, and then republish them. And as I said, if you go to Wikipedia, you can see this long, long list of his books. Fantastic author and a fantastic man. It was wonderful the first time I met him here at the Vinoy Hotel at BoucherCon, and I walked up to him, and I said to him, and he's very tall, and I said to him, he didn't know who I was. I walk up to him, and he said, "You have to hug me." He looks at me, he said, "What?" He said, I said, I'm Patsy with a Z. And so he hugged me right away because, of course, by then he had already been on the program several times. And he's just a wonderful, wonderful person. And so I skipped all the commercials today. I want to thank Glenn Erickson so much for all of his support for Joy on Paper. And, of course, Bill Larson of Larson & Larson, intellectual property lawyer, and our legal eagle. He's going to be on in July and answering all of your questions. And there are so many things happening in the legal world regarding books and also regarding social media that you guys have to be careful about. And one of the things that Larry talks about in his book is people who were paying $5 to agents in those days, which would be probably $500 today, and it was a scam. And so that's one of the things that we're going to be talking about with Bill Larson when he comes on. So anyway, they both understand why I didn't do any commercials today, because I didn't want to stop Larry in the middle of everything and talking about this really fascinating book. I needed a book, actually, that made me laugh out loud. And A Writer Prepares is one of those books. It's just like you actually feel like you're sitting there talking to him across the table and having a cup of coffee. A really great read. And as I said, books by writers about themselves can be an inspiration. And when you read this book, you will be inspired. You'll say, my goodness, at his age, he tackled this entire process of marketing books online before anybody else. He was, I think, one of the first authors to realize the potential. And boy, oh boy, did he swing into action. And you can see now, he's selling book after book after book, all because he learned how to do it. And he taught himself. And that's the wonderful thing. You have to take responsibility. Charles Dickens took responsibility. And he went out there and he did lecture after lecture after lecture, book tour after book tour. And that's the kind of thing that all of you have to learn. And Lawrence Block is a great example. And you can check out his website. And you get some ideas just from reading that. Because if you don't promote yourself, nobody will. You cannot be the Jane Austen of today. You cannot sit back and wait for somebody to come along and start pushing your book. You have to push it yourself. Because remember, one of the things I always tell you is that one of the joys of life is to see your words on paper or to hear them spoken in an audible book, or if you're very, very lucky, to hear those magic words, lights, camera, action, and your book will be turned into a major motion picture, streaming video, or perhaps a series on the Hallmark Channel, like I'm hoping for Carol J. Perry and her Witch City Mysteries. You know, Larry Block has had quite a few of his books optioned, a few made into movies, and we'll talk about that at another time, but I'm telling you all, don't fall for scams. After you heard about this, people paying $5, which it was just a scam. So you be careful out there. Don't fall for scams. Meanwhile, say something nice to somebody today, and I will say something nice to Big Ed in the control room. Big Ed, thank you for everything you do for me. And boy, he saluted me, and I saluted him. And it is a glorious day here in Florida. We're sorry about what's happening in Miami. So go check up on that and say prayers for those people. Anyway, bye-bye now.